6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision flyby helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a union man, brother firefighters.
And welcome to A Public Affair there. A little bit of the sounds of Tom Morello recorded at the Capitol here in Madison, Wisconsin, just about exactly a year ago. I think that was like February 25th or something. I'm looking around the room to try and get anybody to remember here. But as a lead-off to our conversation today about a brand new book, It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest, edited by Mary Jo Buell and Paul Buell, and with an introduction by John Nichols, an afterword by Michael Moore, and a chapter by Tom Morello, based on that visit to Madison in the cold February of 2011. Welcome to A Public Affair. Here in the studio with me, several people who contributed to this book, and I'll just go around and let you all say hello and introduce yourselves. Frank Emspach, welcome.
Hi, here we are. Paul was kind enough to ask me to help him write this chapter, and we did that, and so it was a pleasure.
And Paul Buell.
Paul Buell, happy to be here again, and I'm delighted to be surrounded by some of the contributors.
And I'm Mary Batari from the Center for Media and Democracy, and also contributed a chapter.
And also Charity Schmidt.
Hi, thank you for having me.
With the Teaching Assistants Association, and we'll be talking about the chapters that all of you have in the book. Before we get to that, though, I want to bring on one other voice here who's not with us in the room, but Mike Konopacki, local political cartoonist and activist, is joining us by phone just really quickly to give us an update on what is happening with the Art in Protest exhibit, an exhibit that was scheduled for the end of March to commemorate the first anniversary of all of the wonderful art that was part of the Wisconsin uprising last February. And Mike, welcome to A Public Affair. What's the status of the Art in Protest plans now?
Well, thank you so much, Norm, and hello, everybody. I'm apologizing for not being there in person because I've been on the phone and gathering emails from people all morning that they want to participate in the Art and Protest or the band Art and Protest show. It's scheduled for March 9th, which is Friday, from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. at the Goodman Community Center at 149 Wabisa Street in Madison. And it will also be Saturday, March 10th, from 4 p.m. to 11 p.m. And it's coinciding with the Reclaim Wisconsin rallies that are going to be taking place on the square. There's a candlelight vigil at 6 p.m. on Friday. And so then at 8 o'clock, people can come over to the Goodman Center. And then on Saturday, there's a pre-rally at 1 p.m., and then the rally begins at 2, and the Goodman Center will be open at 4, so people who attend the rally can take their signs and bring them over to the Goodman Center and have a good time until 11 p.m.
And of course, the story behind this is that the Art in Protest event was originally going to be a three-day conference modeled on the Great Labor Arts Exchange that takes place in Washington, D.C. every year for the last 34 years, and was scheduled to take place at the Pyle Center, sponsored by the UW School for Workers, but then following pressure from Republicans in the state assembly, particularly Steve Nass of Whitewater, the School for Workers dropped its support for that event, and so now it's moved to a different location and an earlier date, and much condensed. So it's just going to be the art show, not the whole three-day conference.
Well, actually, I got an email from the Poets Laureate of Madison, who want to be part of the show, and I've been getting calls from the Bonobo Secret Handshake and other musicians, and so we're meeting today with Steve Gotcher, who's our sound guy, and he's going to help us figure out how we can have people do some music there. So it'll be a fun event, and we're planning all of this as we speak. So we're encouraging people to come, and we can't archive art and we can't collect art, but we do want people to come and bring their signs, bring their banners, bring their posters, and you know, exchange their form of expression with the folks that are going to be there this weekend.
Okay, great. Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining us. And in full disclosure, you and I authored a piece that should be out in the paper later this week discussing kind of the history of this controversy. And so there'll be more information about that available.
Yes, there should be a print version in the Wednesday Capital Times weekly section. And there is another article that's already online discussing the history of Siftwing and Winnowing by a local historian. And so there is something on the Cap Times website as we speak, but we'll have something on Wednesday.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And you're listening to A Public Affair here on WORT. My name is Norman Stockwell. I'm your host today. And with me in the studio, a bunch of people who have contributed to this wonderful new book, It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. Let's take a look at the whole notion of it started in Wisconsin. And let me throw this first to you, Frank. Your section of the book is kind of a history of labor protest in the state of Wisconsin. You and Paul Buell co-authored a chapter that talks about some of the roots of a lot of the struggles that are happening today. The title is Labor, Social Solidarity, and the Wisconsin Winter. Talk about the tradition here in Wisconsin of labor struggle.
Well, I think that Wisconsin has had a long history of labor struggle, not in Madison and Milwaukee as much as other places, for instance, the Fox Valley in the northern part of the state, where you had Finnish iron miners organizing. In Milwaukee, you had a long period of leftist and socialist government. And then, of course, you had a more conservative union movement here for many, many years. It's sort of funny because some of the unions that are most conservative are now much more radical. You had a very strong American Federation of Labor in Wisconsin and a relatively weaker Congress of Industrial Organizations, which was seen in 1940 as the left and the AFL at the right. And AFSCME here, which began here, was an AFL union. And very, very business-minded and conservative, and people dressed like, the management. But they felt that there was a confluence of interests between the management and the workers. And I think what happened here, actually, is that notion was destroyed by Governor Walker. And the lingering doubts that these folks might be our friends disappeared. And that's why 125,000 people came out. I believe they were insulted. They felt maligned. And that sort of contradicted a whole sort of social history in many ways here.
It's interesting because, of course, I'm sure that all of these chapters, you know, were written by each of you at different times and so on. But one of the things I noted in this section, and again, the chapter called Labor, Social Solidarity, and the Wisconsin Winter, ends sort of not knowing what's going to happen next.
That's right.
And I guess that's true of the, you know, of the struggle in general.
This wasn't fiction, you know. Right. We had to end it someplace.
Right.
We could have made it up.
Yeah. But one of the things that you talk about in here is the fact that a lot of the kind of, I guess we call it direct action components of the union part of the protests got switched into a more focus on the recalls, beginning with that rally in June.
With the verbiage right. coming out that right. Calling for recall. And just as an aside, I think the Labor Notes conference we had here in April really made those issues clearer. And I think we're seeing it today where there's tremendous resources in Plan A, but not so many resources on Plan B. And just my personal opinion here, just speaking for myself, without a Plan B, you're not going to get to a Plan A. And I say that because of what we saw in the civil rights movement. Without the people actively working in their workplace or on the street, it makes the electoral issue seem pretty far out. But if, in fact, you have people working on the street, working in their workplace, demanding rights, then the electoral solution seems pretty moderate. And I think if we do not do both, we may lose both.
It's very interesting. You know, the Blue Book, which is a fairly dry document, usually the state of Wisconsin Blue Book that includes all the information about the state constitution and the different legislators and what their districts are and so on. This year has several photographs of the Capitol protests in it. But the other thing that it has, and this was scheduled a long time ago, was the 100th anniversary of progressivism in Wisconsin, the 1911 Wisconsin legislature. And it starts out, the 1911 legislature met during high noon of the progressive era in the state and the nation. The electorate's growing perception that regular Republican policies aggrandized the rich and powerful prompted a decisive shift toward candidates who advocated government intervention on behalf of other segments of society. And so 100 years ago, this was the conversation, was electoral solutions to inequities that were being promoted by the 1911 Republican Party. And so the conclusion is kind of nice, too. They quote a longtime member of the Legislative Reference Bureau staff and legislative historian, "The legislature's influence is still felt in Wisconsin and has extended to other states," the 1911 legislature. "The 1911 lawmakers laid the foundation for Wisconsin's traditions of environmental stewardship and clean government. It built a structure for state government that is still visible. It is, by a considerable margin, the most impressive legislature in Wisconsin history, and I would be surprised if a legislature in any other state can match its achievements." So that was 100 years ago, and here we are today, 2011, with the events of the protests here in Wisconsin. 256-2001 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We have a caller on the line, and we're going to keep going around and talking to our other contributors. Again, the book, It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest, brand new out from Verso, and the book event is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Goodman Center. A number of the authors will be there. But let's go to the phones right now. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was 17 years as a UAW worker and union member. And, you know, what happened to the UAW prior to this? 1990, I took a buyout from the General Motors plant, and my union had already been so compromised to the point that quite actually, in 1983, General Motors succeeded in getting our local to whipsaw open a national agreement that, you know, basically when you see Mike Morris, Roger, and me, what was done to Flint, Michigan, primarily kind of happened because Local 95 here opened up a national agreement right in the middle and restructured work rules, line speed, you name it. The other end of it, when I left in 90, you know, the union had become such a tool for management that in written contract language, they actually agreed to enter into a program of accelerated induced attrition. to achieve the level of the jobs bank, which basically meant giving work to people in the jobs bank who had seniority, had totally expired, had no union rights whatsoever. But the company paid seniority workers to leave to get a defeasancy from those union rights to replace them with an employee of their choice that didn't get to full wages for 4 years after they took that agreement. But the induced accelerated attrition. Look up attrition.
Okay, let me get. We've got some more people on the line. Let me get you to sort of come to a point, and then I'll get our panelists to comment on that.
I guess, you know, part of what bothers me here is the people on the street in Madison, when GM got bailed out with taxpayer dollars and announced that they were opening the plant in Mexico, no one protested in front of any GM dealerships. Okay, no one. And the polarization effect. I don't want to see this issue with Walker get polarized straight between union and non-union, because to me it's a no-win situation. The worst thing Walker did was lower the punitive damages cap to $200,000. In 1976, Paul Harms represented Ford Pinto victims, and he showed conclusively that if Ford Motors could have punched in a $250,000 cap on punitive damages in 1976, they never would have quit making the Ford Pinto. This is the most disturbing thing Walker's done. And so, you know, I just, I don't know, I'd like to see a little bit more reasoning than, you know, just strictly making it a union issue.
Okay, thank you very much for that call. Frank, do you want to?
Well, only this. We now have an automobile settlement where the deal was that workers would get a 50% wage cut, and they would never get contractually the full amount. So I think that we have a slippery slope here. In the GE negotiations, also nothing was done here in spite of GE Medical. We lost our guaranteed defined pension plan, which, as a personal matter, my father helped negotiate in 1938. So it was, as far as I'm concerned, a devastating blow. And I think the caller is right. Unless we see serious unity between all workers here, going after the corporations and going after the state, we're not going to get anywhere.
The point that the caller raises about punitive damages, Mary Batari, let me ask you to jump in on that, because I know you've done some work on the whole issue of sort of corporate responsibility for bad products. What about that?
Well, it was a very good question, because what my chapter is about in the book is about the corporate agenda behind Scott Walker's agenda and the Fitzgerald brothers' agenda. And, you know, a meeting took place in December 10th, I think, 2010, that none of us knew about. And it was a whole bunch of legislators had just been swept into office after the November 2010 election. And they all ran off to Washington, D.C. at their major ALEC get ready, get set.
And ALEC is the American meeting. Legislative Exchange Council. We'll talk about that in a second. What
which
they are,
is which brings together right wing legislators and corporations to vote behind closed doors on legislative bills that are then taken back to the states and introduced in state houses without any disclosure of the corporate role in creating the bill. So they came back from this ALEC meeting, and the first bill passed by the legislature was the health care savings account, which is a tax break mostly for the wealthy. And the second bill passed by the legislature was a tort reform bill, which took away people's rights to sue if they were injured or killed by corporations. And there's been a number of iterations of these so-called tort reform bills. There are also voter ID bills and bills to privatize the bail bond system and anti-immigration bills and very strange, weird tobacco tax breaks for out-of-state tobacco companies. And then, of course, there was the famous collective bargaining bill, many aspects of which have ALEC DNA. And this agenda swept through the state, sweeping through many states at the same time. And we were all like, many of us suspected ALEC, but we didn't know it was ALEC. And it has been a backbone for forwarding these types of radical proposals.
The book is It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. With me here in the studio, a number of the contributors, along with editor Paul Buell. And Mary, in your chapter called The Sale of Wisconsin, you list a bunch of the model legislation from ALEC, but you also have a little section where you talk about Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, and how she uses the term disaster capitalism. And then you quote from Milton Friedman, who, as you say here, famously said, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real changes. When the crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around." And that, I think, is really the key to what happened here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, is that Alec took advantage of that vacuum, if you will, and created ideas that were lying around, so that when we had the what turns out to have been manufactured crisis of the Wisconsin budget deficit, that was what immediately people looked to plug the hole.
Right. But there was a real crisis, and we have to go back to the real crisis. The 2008 financial crisis totally tanked state revenues. 8 million people lost their jobs. If they're not paying taxes, it severely deepened the budget crisis. And the right moved in lockstep very quickly to name this problem. And the problem wasn't Wall Street. And the problem wasn't the banksters and reckless gambling. The problem became public workers. And so they used the crisis to try and turn public perception against public workers, greedy public workers, as if they had been out on Wall Street gambling with derivatives or buying, if our Wisconsin teachers had been buying credit default swaps, to try and convince people that it was public workers that were the problem. And so their justification for the collective bargaining bill is, we are broke, we have to do this, it's a fiscal measure. And the and in Wisconsin, people finally stood up and said, we have had it. This is not the direction we're going to go in. And that's what caught national attention and prompted the book.
256-2001 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation about the book, It Started in Wisconsin. And we have several people here. We're going through some of the different sections of the book. There's an event tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Goodman Center where you can hear more about the book, see copies of it, talk to the people that contributed to it. But right now, you can give us a call at 256-2001. And hello, caller, you're on the air. Caller?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to take us back to last spring and just talk about the uprising and where kind of the labor movement is today, 1 year later. I think what happened, you know, Mary said was right. People have had it. But I think last year people didn't see any other alternative other than rising up. And it was their decision to do that. We provided, or labor provided, the mechanism and the communication and the call to action. And people responded in ways that are unprecedented and we've never seen and never thought we would see. I think Frank is probably the first to agree that the public sector, because of the, you know, no strike, meet arb laws, are weak, because they've never had to go out and fight, you know, for their contracts. And that's the state we were in during the uprising. Now, what I see going on is, and that was all organic, what I see going on is a lot more of that organic activity bubbling up. We're seeing young activists coming into the labor movement and asking questions about how their unions work, and they're getting involved and they're plugging in. But still there's this chorus singing, we're not doing anything, we have to be out in the streets. Well, we'll be out in the streets again when the people decide that there's no alternative.
Okay.
And, you know, I was down there quite a bit last spring, and it wasn't the labor leaders that were calling for a recall, it was the people. People were showing up with signs just not long, maybe 2 weeks after, as the protests continued, recall Walker. And, you know, it was those people, they were organizing themselves, getting their petitions together, fighting out the processes, and, you know, making a movement. It was not the labor leaders. The labor leaders I talked with said, oh, that sounds like a long shot. So that's just my perspective.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I'll hang up and see if there's any response.
Thank you very much for that call. Let me actually toss this to you, Charity Schmidt, talking about younger activists, and you're a graduate student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, an active member of the Teaching Assistants Association, and you folks were out there, and you tell this story in your chapter in the book, which is called Spread the Love, Stop the Hate, Don't Let Walker Legislate. You tell the story of young students getting involved in this movement right from the start.
Right, and I think the caller has an interesting point about the organic process that went on and about how so many people from so many different walks of Wisconsin played a role. And I was so happy and proud to contribute to this book because a lot of people didn't know what happened before the media showed up. So what happened the weekend of Walker's announcement of the budget repair bill and how we pushed for a public hearing. And so the political work that went into that weekend needed to be documented, and we need to learn lessons from that. And so I was happy to write this piece showing kind of the steps that led up this organic process of both some labor leaders, but mostly the rank and file. And what we saw leading up to the public hearing and throughout the protests was that the rank and file was indeed in front of the leadership and really pushing their leadership to put resources, to put time into these more direct mass protests and mobilization. And I think that was really the power in it, that everyone played a role and that really people, ordinary people, the rank and file, young people, students especially, really pushed everyone, and they pushed the envelope and they pushed the momentum to build what we saw last spring.
Yeah, you know, I was in Dakar, Senegal, when the news came that Walker had said he was going to call out the National Guard to break any kind of strikes that happened in response to this legislation that he was planning to push the following week, and flew back here to Madison on that Monday. But my daughter was in the protest at the governor's mansion on Sunday, and then she was with 700 of her fellow East High School students marching up to the Capitol on Wednesday when the students marched up to the Capitol. About the brand new book, It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. And it's full of these eyewitness accounts like Charity's. It's full of analytical pieces like the ones that Frank and Mary were talking about. It's also full of some great graphics, and we'll talk about those in a little bit as well, because Paul Buell, I know you are a specialist in getting out the graphic images that tell a story. But we have some more callers on the phone, and let's keep going to the phones. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Norman. I just wanted to bring up another example that unfortunately has largely been forgotten around here about a company that took very repressive anti-union action. This was in the private sector. This was CUNA Mutual. And the annoying thing, or the most outrageous thing there, was that they brought in a professional union-busting attorney, Sugg, who had previously come from Caterpillar Tractor in Peoria. He came up here to do his dirty tricks. He created a lot of unpleasantness in the company. Essentially, the company lost the first round in the case of CUNA Mutual because their tactics were so incredibly stupid that they ended up, I suspect, paying more out in settlements than they benefited from eliminating union positions. But I think we should be aware of that, because CUNA Mutual has been able to mount a very slick public relations campaign to the extent that everyone seems to have forgotten about the situation there. And this isn't something that happened a long time ago that is no longer relevant. It's actually very relevant, and let me explain why. One reason is that the CUNA Mutual Foundation maintains a very high profile locally with its awards. For example, the Goodman Center, of which you just spoke of, if you go there and look at the supposed benefactors to the Goodman Center, you'll see the CUNA Mutual Foundation listed. And also, with regard to the charter school movement, the CUNA Mutual Foundation took a very active role in supporting the controversial charter school. And what makes me wonder is, what would be their pound of flesh that they would like to see from the charter school? And I suspect they would like to, in some way, instill either non-union or anti-union values in the people, in its students, I mean.
Okay.
I guess that's just my opinion, and I'll take answers off the air, and thanks for taking the call.
Thank you very much. And you're listening to A Public Affair. We still have some more people holding on the phone, so I think I'm going to go to another caller, and then we'll get some more comments from our guests here in the studio. But hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello, Norm.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, in all of the anger against Walker, of course, we forget his predecessor, Governor Doyle, and also the fact that given the economic crash of 2008 and the Obama and the Democrats, they bailed out Wall Street, they didn't bail out the homeowners, they didn't pay, the first thing that went off the table was the Employee Free Choice Act, very weak stimulus, et cetera, so that the disappointment in Democrat-administered austerity locally and nationally caused low voter turnout in 2010, so the right wing comes roaring back. The question I have to the panel is, you know, is there a way forward beyond labor's abject dependence on the Democratic Party? What you saw at the square was a year ago was very inspiring. I wouldn't exactly call it direct action because that's, you know, when you do actually, you know, blockade or occupy with the intention of not leaving, you know, when the governor or somebody else finally tells you to leave, but you stay. But it was a huge symbolic outpouring. I would call it the liberal outpouring. I wouldn't call it an uprising. But given where we are now, do you see a way forward, you know, in the workplaces and in the streets, you know, beyond simply trying to get these corporate Democrats elected in Wisconsin and get them reelected this year, later this year, nationally? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that call. And you're listening to A Public Affair here on WRT. We're speaking with a number of people who contributed to the brand new book, It Started in Wisconsin. With us here in the studio, editor Paul Buell and contributor as well, and also Frank Emspach, Mary Batari, and Charity Schmidt. And we're taking your calls at 256-2001. The first caller there talks about the fact that we certainly have seen, you know, the legacy of anti-union activity by corporations in the past. The second caller says that we certainly have seen even when we've had Democratic majorities in both houses and the executive branch, that things haven't been changed to benefit working people. In fact, austerity measures have been imposed. I remember when Doyle came into office, he talked about how many jobs he was going to cut from the state workforce. So what about that? Let me start. Paul, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I do, on behalf of an essayist who isn't in the room, that is to say Roger Bybee, who was for decades editor of Kenosha or Racine Labor. And Racine Labor News, and is in many ways the senior labor reporter in the state. His essay describes in considerable detail how the disappearance of industrial jobs from 1970 or so onward was met by apologies from Democratic politicians, governors, and so forth, apologies not to the workers but to the corporations, with special financial treats to them, which achieved the goal only of letting them leave earlier with more money. And no fight back to speak of, or it was pretty rare, and efforts to hold anybody's political nose to the grindstone and deal with the devastating effects of things like NAFTA, as sponsored by President Clinton, were mighty few. So that Bybee essay covers the material much better than I could, and I think gives people the historical background that would be very useful for them to understand this phenomenon.
Well, I think there's this. What happened here, in my opinion, was that the liberal Democrats basically said, look, people are in trouble. We have to take care of them and give them trade assistance adjustment money and so forth. But never did anything to privatize the cost of moving. The cost of moving out were socialized. The rest of us paid for it. The companies left. There was no consequences whatsoever. And I think the whole point here is that the Democratic Party in this regard lost its ability to defend or even willingness to defend working people in the ways that are most important, which is employment, not some kind of trade adjustment deal, which did not cover much of anything. And I think that what's happening here is that this is now all coming home to roost, because the right wing has an agenda that's very clear: help the corporations. And progressives and liberals are saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? Let's not give them so much. But we can't go back to where we were and defend the working people and say, for example, in this state, that tuition for the university should be something that working people can come to. Instead of $125 like it was in 1961, it's thousands. And so it's this kind of basic move that has to be made, in my opinion, if we're going to talk seriously about a revival of a progressive movement, a progressive polity, and a progressive organization in terms of a progressive party.
The other thing I think, too, is that, you know, whereas we've had these periods where Democrats have been in power and majority in both houses and so on, they don't seem to have all of this model legislation prepared. They don't seem to have the think tanks that are prepping this kind of stuff. I don't think we've seen, probably since the New Deal, an overarching set of programs that push forward a progressive agenda. And, of course, we talked at the beginning of the show about the 1911 Wisconsin legislature and the progressive movement, which did have that kind of comprehensive progressive agenda. And that's where a lot of our legislation, you know, child labor laws and workers' compensation and so on, came out of Wisconsin 100 years ago. And then again in the 30s, we had things like the creation of AFSCME, the Public Workers Union, you know, again, coming out of these overarching agendas. And now instead what we have is the Republicans sort of have that territory. They are the ones that run these groups like ALEC.
And it's been 30 years in the planning. I mean, they've done a really good job. I mean, ALEC was in part a response to the 70s, where progressives made a lot of gains with the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And
all under Richard Nixon, by the way.
All under Richard Nixon.
Our most progressive president in that way.
Even my lifetime, my friend. And
that's true.
Paul's been
OSHA.
Saying.
OSHA. Well, that's OSHA.
And we sort of dropped the ball. They like to compare, you know, the Republicans, Scott Fitzgerald and Jeff Fitzgerald will say, well, there's NCSL, and it's a progressive organization that does the same thing. But corporations are not members of NCSL, and corporations don't vote at NCSL. And frankly, NCSL doesn't even create model legislation. So we can learn from mimicking some of their moves. I mean, that could be one strategy. But I liked what the caller said about what are we going to do that's beyond party here. And I think party's important. I think the recall effort's important. I hope people are going to get out and vote. But I would hope that there would also be a continuation of this dialogue that we've started in Wisconsin. I mean, when we were all camped out in the Capitol, we all had each other's cell phone numbers. We all got to know each other. You know, there was a conversation started across all sorts of barriers that I hope will continue under some sort of structure formally. I don't know if it's We Are Wisconsin or if it's United Wisconsin or it's Wisconsin Wave or whatever, but we have to create those structures so that we can continue to be part of each other's fights.
And the book is It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest, edited by Mary Jo Buell and Paul Buell. Paul Buell here in the studio with us, along with several of the contributors to this book, Frank Imsbeck, Mary Batari, and Charity Schmidt. Three people holding on the phones right now, so let's go to the phones, and we'll take let's go ahead and take three calls in a row just to get those people to have a chance to speak, and then we'll get some more responses from our panelists. Go ahead, caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, a previous caller mentioned things that have sort of disappeared into non-history, and one of the things that happened in Wisconsin was about 80 years ago, in the face of enormity of foreclosure on farms, there was a bill in the assembly to put a stop to that, to simply have a moratorium. And the Speaker of the House sat on it and wouldn't let it come up for a vote, at which time a large number of these unruly Wisconsin farmers went into the Capitol, went into the Speaker's office, dragged the Speaker out of his office over to up on the second floor, and hung him by his ankles from the second floor balcony over that railing. And they only asked him one question: will you let that bill come up for a vote? And he said, sure. And they actually got it done that way. And it kind of follows the Webley direct action, bringing satisfaction. But right now, the movement is heavily in favor of Fannie Lou Hamer, Mohandas Gandhi's nonviolent resistance. And both are equal in my eyes. There's a good reason for direct action. And when you get 125,000 or 150,000 people at the Capitol, you'd think that a guy like Walker would be quaking in his boots. But a lot of people have tried to convince me he's a moron. And I've kind of got the feeling it's an insult to morons.
Okay.
Thanks for the program. There's
Thank
a
you.
Lot
Thank
of
you for
good
that call.
History being talked about.
Thank you for that call. And I will point out that you can have nonviolent direct action. The direct action can be nonviolent. And let's go to another caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Caller?
Hello, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, thanks. I wanted to mention one historical thing and then suggest a plan B or C that we could pursue. Historically, I think it's important for people to understand why we don't have strong third parties in our country. Some friends and I had a chance to interview Mayor Frank Zeidler, the last socialist mayor of Milwaukee, and he lasted until about 1964. And he felt the reason he lost that election was because in the state capitol in Madison, the Democrats and Republicans had been scheming for years how could they weaken the socialists in Milwaukee. And so finally they were able to pass a nonpartisan local election law, which makes it illegal to put the name of the political party next to the candidate's name when they're running for mayor or alderman. He said the effect of that was most people started voting along ethnic lines in Milwaukee. If you were Polish American, you just voted for someone with a Polish name. Now, regarding the plan B that we could pursue, there's this wonderful movie about how the British ended slavery nonviolently about 30 years before we did in our country. And it's called Amazing Grace. And because a slave ship captain without remorse, he wrote that famous song. But anyways, if we apply the strategies from that movie to our times, they did all the things we're doing now. They collected like 3.5 million signatures against slavery in England and then enrolled it on the floor of the parliament. That's very dramatic and wonderful. But because the slave traders always had more votes than the abolitionists, they could never win. So finally they figured out a way of destroying the profits of the slave trade. Now, if we look at who's backing Walker, Koch Industries, and other companies like that, they supply natural gas to most of the power plants in Wisconsin, including the 30 state power plants. We should be boycotting energy, because what's going to happen here is we're going to have what's going on in Greece eventually. Whereas if we target our boycott right now against energy and demand renewable energy, that would create a lot of union jobs, and it would take money away from the people who buy off enough legislators. If we took that money away, then our side could buy off more votes. So thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that call. You're listening to A Public Affair. With me here in the studio, folks from the book It Started in Wisconsin. We have one more caller we want to take here in this group. And hello, caller, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I think there has been a support structure built to support the labor movement and the progressive movement in general. And I would just like to point to Mary's organization as one of those that counters, you know, the countervailing force to ALEC. But we have things like Wisconsin Citizen Action, the Institute for Wisconsin's Future that does research and tax policy, and Citizen Action does healthcare policy and
And there's, of course, a AFL-CIO who's got it, that has an agenda. Right now it's a fight-back agenda, unfortunately, but there is a legislative agenda that gets put forth, and people apparently aren't aware of that. So I just like to put that out and suggest that people go check into some of these organizations. If I had my list in front of me, I could give you more organizations like that, but these are largely labor-supported organizations that are out there to do the research and a lot of the, you know, the legislative mobilization and action that we need. And I think back to when we almost had universal health care, which was AFL-CIO's, the state feds initiative, mm-hmm. Healthy Wisconsin. John Rippenbach helped us get it passed, through the Senate. And, you know, we should have been there in the streets then, insisting that that go through. And here we are today. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. And, of course, a couple other organizations worth noting. COWS, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Terry, you do some work with them sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're a great way of looking at alternatives to the system we are currently under and building towards policy alternatives to what we're seeing get passed through groups like ALEC.
And I also want, of course, tip a hat to Workers Independent News. Frank, your organization that is the longest running now labor news service, I think, in at least in recent U.S. history, if not in the entire history of the U.S., on commercial and non-commercial radio stations across the country, bringing information about these sorts of issues to working people, not just union members, but working people across the United States.
Well, of course, WORT is partially responsible for that, as long as we're all congratulating each other here. But I really think some of the points here are well taken. I want to just say that it's not a question of saying you have electoral work or this. I think we need to really take a look at both. I also think it's possible to talk seriously about a working people's agenda that's different than a corporate bailout agenda, which the Democrats tend to look at quite a bit, and then sort of say, well, we should help out people who are unfortunate with this or that subsidy. I really think that we here have to move this discussion to say that when you take a job from somebody, it's theft, and we don't like that in Wisconsin or any place else, and we're going to treat that way. And if we really believe this is important, and somebody is moving machinery from some factory to move it someplace else, and perhaps you should employ what Norm's talking about, this nonviolent disobedience, and sit there. Or if your job in the state service is being privatized or given away to your friends or the governor's friends, maybe it's time to say, hey, look, what's going on here? It costs more money, less service, they're stealing our jobs, and they're robbing the taxpayer, and not pussyfoot around, because I think that the fact of the matter is we can be very clear and articulate and honest about what's happening, and if we don't do that and don't have the kind of agenda that people can understand, then we're not going to be able to convince people that they should get rid of the governor or, in fact, change what is a well-thought-out, internally coherent agenda that basically lowers wages, lowers benefits, and increases corporate profits.
And the book is It Started in Wisconsin, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Labor Protest. Paul, I want to talk a minute about the graphics in here, because there's some wonderful stuff, including a comic history of the teacher's strike here in Wisconsin that Sharon Rudall of Milwaukee did, and that you wrote did some of the research for. First time I have seen this story told in graphic form.
I guess it's because I was looking at some of the smaller details, supposedly smaller details, of labor history in Wisconsin, and also because I've been working for some years with Sharon Rudall, who was the first art editor of a new underground newspaper in 1970 in Madison Takeover. It tells a little story about what happened in Hortonville and how Madison teachers and Milwaukee teachers responded to that. There's another longer comic and broken up in two parts by Nick Torkelson, who was the very first underground comics artist in Madison. He drew for the Press Connection, the earlier underground newspaper in Madison. So comics are a way to get the message across and express it artistically, and we're lucky to have several really fine political-minded artists who, in fact, have passed in Wisconsin and regarded as a second home.
And, of course, also a story of the teaching assistants, the TAA formed here in Madison, of which you were a part, Paul.
Indeed.
And Charity is currently a part of. And that art is done by Gary Dumm, who's also doing a comic right now about the Port Huron Statement, the founding document of SDS, which will be celebrating its 50th anniversary this spring.
That's right, and I can't quite let us go by without mentioning the other graphic parts of the book, which are a dozen photographs, fully half of which were taken by Mary Batari, and the other half by various artists from here all the way to a photographer from Minneapolis. So they sort of fill out the book and make sense of the whole thing in terms other than words.
And the last graphic in here by local artist Lester Doré, Occupy Madison, Throw the Bosses Off Your Back, which is kind of, I guess, if you will, sort of what I think this book is all about. It started in Wisconsin, leads you to say, well, where else did it go? And I think the thing that I have seen with the Occupy movement is a lot of people in the Occupy movement talk about the inspiration of the Wisconsin movement that sort of kicked things off here in February a year ago.
And they show up when Walker shows up in their town.
Right, that's right. Exactly.
That's right.
Like in Florida.
So again, thank you all for being with us here on A Public Affair today. We are out of time, but I want to thank Frank Emsbeck of Workers Independent News, Paul Buell, retired academic and now producer of these comics and graphic novels, Mary Batari of the Center for Media and Democracy, which runs, among other things, the Alec Exposed website, and Charity Schmidt of Teaching Assistants Association and other things around town. Thank you all so much. It started in Wisconsin, but it's still going on.